Orson Scott Card is the author of a short story called Mortal Gods. In it, aliens travel across the galaxies to Earth. Now, they are an older species than humanity, much older. Each individual alien lives for many hundreds of thousands of years. And what's even more, they do not reproduce in the same way that we humans do. Instead, like the amoeba, they reproduce by splitting apart. What this does for them, they explain, is it replicates in each individual the memories of their earliest species. Each alien contains within it the memory not only of its very, very long life, but also the memory of the entire race which lived in galaxies and universes millions and millions of years ago. Each alien is thus deeply wise, heavy with the wisdom of its ancient past. So these aliens show up to Earth and they want to set up shop. And they work out an exchange with human beings. They agree to barter some of their superior wisdom with humans if humans give them land rights. And they don't want land rights anywhere. They want land rights in the strangest places. They want human beings to let them construct buildings inside of human graveyards. These buildings look like churches, mosques, and temples. Now, all is well for a time, and humanity and this race of aliens that they've newly confronted, they coexist happily, until one day when Willard Crane decides to stop by. Willard Crane is a cranky old man. And he decides that life has gotten dull and he wants to start a fight in order to spice it up. So he decides to pick a fight with the aliens. So he crashes into one of the graveyard temples and he demands to speak to the alien that is in charge. He wants to know why these aliens are building in such strange spots. And why do the buildings look the way they do, like sanctuaries? The alien who deigns to respond is exceedingly polite. It says, "Why, Mr. Crane, we've answered that question thousands of times. We like churches. We find them to be the most graceful and beautiful of all human architecture." But Willard Crane is not satisfied with that response. "It's no response at all," he claims. In fact, the alien is simply dodging the question. He calls the alien a slippery bastard. Why has this particular alien drug itself from one side of the universe to the other? Why has it put in the effort of crafting temples inside of graveyards? Why is it bothering to converse with Willard Crane in that particular moment at all? Doesn't it have better things to do? It just doesn't make sense. And so Willard Crane demands a response to all of his questions. "Can you keep a secret?" the alien asks. "Then here's one to keep. We come, Mr. Crane, to worship." They come, it turns out, to worship people. Willard Crane thinks that this is madness, and he tells the alien just that. But unperturbed, the alien asks for patience as it tries to explain. "You see, Mr. Crane, we remember everything. From the first stirrings of the intellect, millions and millions of years ago, all the way up to the present. When we were born, so to speak, we have no need for teachers. We've never learned to write. We have never learned to create beauty to outlast our lives because nothing outlasts our lives. We live to see all of our works and creations crumble. But here, Mr. Crane, we have found a race that builds for the sheer joy of building, that creates beauty, that writes books, a race that devises immortal gods to worship and celebrates its own mortality with immense pomp and glory. Death is the foundation of all that is great about humanity, Mr. Crane. We do not have that, and so we come to worship. What a bunch of malarkey, Willard Crane implores. If temporary life is all these aliens care about, well, then they might as well be worshiping fruit flies. They live only a day. But the alien persists. Everything you do smacks of death, and it is beautiful. Your poems have beginnings and endings and structures that limit the work. Your paintings have edges marking off where beauty begins and ends. Your sculptures isolate a single moment in time. Your music starts and it finishes. All that you do is mortal. It is all born and it all dies. He finishes by looking into this bewildered man's eyes and saying, Mr. Crane, for this reason exactly, you are beautiful. I get goosebumps when I read this story. I think that there is something profound in what it is offering, even though its characters are a bit quirky and strange. But there is some deep meditation on life and death that is happening in its pages. The alien is saying that the particular works that we humans create are beautiful because of their transient qualities. Death limits and defines all of our efforts. Our poems have endings and our art has edges. The music we create, it starts and it finishes. The reality of this limitedness causes us to pour extraordinary effort into some small, narrow thing, like a painting or a score of music, a work that expresses a particular and limited beauty. Beauty, it says, is thus marked by, no, defined by mortality. Death, it says, also imposes urgency on our human efforts. We create great and beautiful works because we know that we only have a brief time to do so. We want to make this particular thing that we do count because we will not always be here. We desire for a book or a piece of art or a monument to carry our impact beyond ourselves into the world even after we are gone. We hope our children carry a lesson forth that we give them, or at the very least, we hope that some good deed that we do has ripple effects that go beyond our lives. And so, in a strange way, part of what the story is also communicating is that by embracing the limits and urgency of mortality, we are also given the possibility of transcending its limits. What a beautiful notion. Of course, it can be a complicated thing to celebrate mortality. Not every social location has an equal relationship with death. There are those who are more vulnerable and exposed because of class and race and gender identity. And it is crucial that we address the justice questions that attend to those uneven realities that people experience. And there are also those of us here today who are aching from loss. And I hope that my words in no way communicates some trite proverb that death is just a part of life, and so why get so worked up about it? It would never, never intend that. One of the ancient texts in Hinduism has something to teach us about this human predicament. Its compilation dates to 400 of the Common Era, but the sayings themselves are much older. Some date those sayings to as early as 1,000 years before the Common Era. These writings are known as the Yoga Sutras, and many consider them to be a divinely inspired text. The author's name is Patanjali, but little is known about him apart from his name. He is so shrouded in mystery and myth that he might as well be a deathless alien. Some songs and chants describe him as a white serpent with several heads, holding a conch shell and a flaming disc in his many hands, capable of eradicating the jungle root of delusion that plagues the human race. In other words, he is envisioned in mythological proportions. Patanjali's sayings themselves are a bit less fantastical. They function as something of a meditation manual. They describe the mental difficulties and anxieties that people experience in their everyday lives, and then through yoga and meditation, they supply a method for people to transcend their hardships. Some psychologists in recent years have done comparative work with them, which I find to be particularly fascinating, looking at the ways that these ancient insights have something valuable to offer us modern people. Now, in the second chapter of the sutras, Patanjali talks about the kleshas. These are often translated as obstacles or impediments to mental clarity and human flourishing. There are five of them, and the last is said to be the deepest and hardest to break. Patanjali calls it abhinivesha. It is translated unevenly into English as clinging to life. Others translate it as the fear of death. Now, part of what Orson Scott Card's story imagines is what it would mean to think about and appreciate life without having to fear death. The aliens do not die and therefore have no fear of death. And the twist is that this is precisely what enables them to value shorter human lives, the transient and the passable, those things that emerge, come into being, and then are extinguished. It enables that alien race to see the beauty and the vibrancy that is a part of mortality. They can appreciate its contours and its edges, its gifts and its genius. Because they have no fear of death, their vision is unclouded, and they are able to appreciate mortality in all of its beautiful richness. This view, I think, is neither morbid nor nihilistic. It is not a rejection of life. Instead, it is what enables us to embrace life by coming to terms with life's limits. As one commentator on the Yoga Sutras writes, we can practice this deep and abiding acceptance of our mortality by living softly with the little deaths that we face in our day-to-day lives. When we let go of the fear of death, we practice living fully and artfully here, right now, without knowledge of what will come tomorrow. In other words, the spiritual practice of accepting mortality allows us to embrace the particular moment that we are in all of its beauty and its richness. And it is in that blessing of life and in our lack of clinging to it that we just may find the space for celebrating the beautiful, the vibrant, the sparkling parts of what makes us human. This embrace of the mortal is what Wallace Stevens intends in his famous poem, Sunday Morning. The poet tries to imagine a paradise without death, contemplating whether its ethereal gifts could have any meaning for us. But after listing ripe fruit that never falls and gorgeous rivers that never meet the sea and perfect skies of endless days, he abruptly rejects the vision. No, he says, such a vision is wrong. It's impossible. What makes a tree heavy with fruit beautiful, or a bright day noteworthy, or a particular moment on a river glorious, is that it is temporary. He thus closes the stanza with his powerful and infamous line, "Death is the mother of beauty." Death is the mother of beauty. Diane Ackerman's thoughts about life are themselves beautiful, and I would like to end with them today because I think that they fit here. This is the wisdom that she would offer us. The great affair, this love affair with life, is to live as variously as possible, to groom one's curiosity like a high-spirited thoroughbred, to climb aboard, to gallop over the thick, sun-struck hills every day. It's true that life began in mystery, and it will end in mystery. But oh, what a savage and beautiful country lies between. May we find ever new ways to love that savage, beautiful, and temporary country that we call life. Amen. I love you, and blessed be.